from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. It's apparently open season on dissidents in the new U.S.-backed Ukraine. Ukrainian journalist Oles Buzina, whose reports challenged the official narrative of the Kiev authorities, was shot dead on Thursday in Kiev. It was the second killing of a political dissident in as many days. CCTV's Kate Parkinson was there and filed this report.
Buzina was a prominent Ukrainian journalist, well known for his pro-Russian views. He was killed in broad daylight here in Kiev on Thursday. Two masked gunmen shot him dead outside his home close to the city center. As you said, his killing coming just one day after another pro-Russian figure was killed here in Kiev. Oleg Kalashnikov, a former member of parliament for the Party of Regions, that's the discredited party of the former ousted President Viktor Yanukovych. He was killed in a similar style attack also here in Kiev. And Kalashnikov's death is the latest in a string of deaths of allies of Yanukovych who've died in mysterious circumstances this year. At least six high-ranking officials have died. Their deaths have been ruled probable suicides, but their political allegiances and former job positions have left many wondering whether in fact they were murdered. And we've seen finger pointing from both sides. The Russian President Vladimir Putin described the killings of Buzina and Kalashnikov, as well as other similar deaths, as being politically motivated, and accused Kiev of failing to bring people to justice. Meanwhile, the Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko described the recent killings as playing into the hands of Kiev's enemies. And an official for the Interior Ministry said he couldn't rule out the possibility that the killings were the work of Russian special forces designed to blacken the image of Kiev's pro-Western government.
Meanwhile, paratroopers of the U.S. 173rd Airborne Brigade, based in Vicenza, Italy, arrived in Western Ukraine to provide training for government troops. The announcement came on the Twitter account of the U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Jeffrey Pyatt, who posted pictures of the U.S. paratroopers marching through the airport in the western Ukrainian city of Lvov. Russia has expressed concern over the military training of Ukrainian forces, saying such actions are not conducive to a settlement with the east of the country. Tony Robinson, the director of Presenza, spoke with RT about the buildup.
There's a not too subtle plot to start a war here. The West, pushed by the U.S., is building itself up for a fight and encouraging Kiev to think that it could win. It kind of recalls the Georgian attempt to start a war in 2008. And despite attempts by Angela Merkel a few weeks ago and the implementation of the ceasefire, there are forces which seem determined to go ahead with this. It's hard to see all of these maneuvers as being anything other than the opening shots of a war. A war, incidentally, in a country with several nuclear power stations and, of course, being the home to Chernobyl. When we talk about the West, we're essentially talking about the USA here, and you have to say that to make an analogy, when something looks like a dog, barks like a dog, and smells like a dog, the conclusion is that you're dealing with a dog. And the same goes for looking for war. For years now, the U.S. has been looking for a new war. It was on the brink of destroying Syria before Russia stepped in with the chemical weapons deal. And although things are moving in a good direction in Iran, it is by no means certain that they will avoid a conflict with the U.S., neither North Korea. And even last month, Obama announced that Venezuela was a threat to the country. So what we're talking about here is a country, the USA, which wants a war.
The Saudi air war against Yemen entered its fourth week and is creating a refugee crisis of mammoth proportions. Press TV's Kaniz Fatima has more.
The ongoing Saudi airstrikes against Yemen have forced thousands of people to seek refuge in the Horn of Africa region. Refugees describe the Saudi aggression against Yemen as terrifying.
There were many people that want to leave, but it was hard because of the fighting and bombing. They had no way of getting out. Some people that own houses and property stayed. I have nothing. I don't have a house or farm or work or a future.
They didn't have time to pack. They just arrived here disoriented and they didn't know what to do. So it's clear that these people need assistance and need help.
Nearly 350 Yemeni refugees arrived at the UN camp in the town of Obok, Djibouti on Thursday. The camp is a temporary transit point, and they will soon be transferred to newly erected refugee camps in northern Djibouti. The UN says it's providing basic assistance for the refugees, with humanitarian agencies expecting tens of thousands of more to flee Yemen in the coming months. The humanitarian situation in Yemen is rapidly deteriorating. Many international aid organizations have sought clearances to dispatch medical and other humanitarian supplies by air and sea to civilians who are in dire need of relief and aid.
Jane Cutter is an editor of the news website Liberation News. She discussed some of the humanitarian costs of the Saudis' bombing campaign and the increasing U.S. involvement in the crisis with Liberation Radio's Sean Garcia.
Well, it's really terrible. The country is in a horrible crisis. I think this is something that would illustrate it. There was a tweet that I saw from someone called Rouge129. To know what it is like in Yemen, turn off electricity, water, heating, eat once a day, fear for your life. I think that's very evocative. According to the Wall Street Journal, at least 648 civilians have been killed so far, many of these children. And the targets that they've been hitting have included refugee camps, hospitals, schools, urban neighborhoods, and even soccer stadiums. The U.S. is increasing its role in the bombing campaign. One of the ways they're doing that is by essentially vetting the Saudi target list, and they've also moved to intercept alleged Iranian aid to the Houthi rebels. So what's interesting about this is that this increase in direct assistance to the Saudi bombing effort is really in contradiction to the Obama administration's stated desire for the Saudis to scale back the bombing campaign and only focus on halting the advances in order to force all parties back to the negotiating table. On the other hand, the Saudis have as their goal the complete destruction of the Houthis' military capability and the restoration of President Hadi, which many in the Obama administration believe is an unrealistic goal, given that more than 2 weeks of bombardment have failed to halt the Houthis, although they were driven out of Aden. So the thing is that the Obama administration's advocacy of a more limited bombing campaign is actually grounded in some understanding of what the reality is on the ground. So on the one hand, the Houthis are not universally popular in Yemen, but the Saudis are even less universally popular, especially considering that they're causing massive civilian casualties right now. So the reality is that the bombing campaign is ultimately likely to politically strengthen the Houthis and other anti-U.S. forces such as Al-Qaeda in the Arabic Peninsula, and other groups of that nature.
Security is tight in South Africa following 2 weeks of xenophobic violence that left 6 immigrants dead. Officials say police have been directed to work around the clock to protect both foreign nationals and citizens. In the past 2 weeks, shops and homes owned by Somalis, Ethiopians, Malawians, Chinese, and other immigrants in Durban and surrounding townships have been targeted, forcing their families to flee to camps protected by armed guards. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma called for the end of violence, with unemployment and poverty levels high in the country. Many accused immigrants of taking jobs that should go to South Africans. Abiyomi Ezekwe is the publisher of the Pan-African Newswire. We spoke with him via Skype on Friday. So we've seen President Zuma condemn the attacks. There were some heated words at the parliamentary session. And I'm just wondering why this and why now? What's the at the basis of this apparent sentiment against foreigners in South Africa?
Well, it needs to be a further investigation to see exactly what is behind it. At this point, we can only speculate, and we feel that it is clearly connected to the overall economic crisis in Southern Africa, in South Africa itself, even though it is considered the second largest economy on the African continent. Since the coming to power of the African National Congress, there has been a systematic disinvestment by international finance capital from the country. For example, during the apartheid system, South Africa was the largest gold producer in the world. That is no longer the case. Today, they only produce approximately 6% of the international gold supply. Countries like Mexico, as well as Ghana, produce more gold now than South Africa. Also, in the platinum industry, where South Africa contains approximately 80% of the platinum resources in the world, which is a very important strategic mineral for the automotive and aerospace industry. Even in that industry, due to the labor unrest over the last 3 years, the strikes, the demand for higher wages, there have been layoffs in the platinum industry as well. And this has gone on in several key sectors of the South African economy. Consequently, unemployment is extremely high. So these are issues that actually fuel this type of xenophobic hysteria. Also, some blame has to be placed on the ruling African National Congress from the standpoint that they have lessened the emphasis on political education. It was a mainstay of the anti-apartheid struggle of the National Liberation Movement. Unfortunately, many of the mass units within the tripartite alliance, meaning COSATU, the South African Communist Party, and the ANC, and other allies, have, in a sense, declined in terms of their political veracity. There's been a split in COSATU. There's been some disaffection from the ANC. So when there is a crisis of both political education as well as political economy, this is going to be a byproduct of that situation.
And now, what's interesting to me is the fact that the entire apartheid system and the post-apartheid system, where the black folks, Africans, living in South Africa, in their own country, the indigenous people may have franchise, political franchise, but they still don't own very much of their country. And the ironic part is that China was one of the major international supporters of the anti-apartheid movement, and their share of the private part of the economy in South Africa is relatively tiny compared to the firms that own all of the mining rights and those that were essentially benefiting from and still benefit from apartheid.
Yes, and the Republic of South Africa under the ANC over the last several years have escalated their economic relations with the People's Republic of China. In fact, now South Africa is part of the BRICS group, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. They have increasingly closer ties. However, you have other Chinese interests in the region, not just in South Africa, but also in neighboring Lesotho, many of whom are from Taiwan, many of whom are in the small and medium-sized sectors of the economy. And there have been tensions between some of the Chinese business interests and poor Africans and working-class people. However, at the same time, most of the focus of these attacks have been directed towards Africans from other countries, particularly in the region. Zimbabwe, for example, there have been reports in the Zimbabwe state media that 800 people have been dislocated from Zimbabwe. Many Zimbabweans live in South Africa. Also, Malawians as well. I believe there was one person from Malawi that was killed, another from Zimbabwe that was killed, as well as other countries. Then you have a lot of people from Nigeria who also live in South Africa, as well as Ethiopia and Somalia. Now, many of the people from the Horn of Africa, from Ethiopia and Somalia, own small shops. These are mainly family businesses, and they, in fact, engage in a lot of business activity dealing with basic consumer goods. So when you have this type of poverty and high unemployment, there is a natural tension between these elements and between people who live in the communities. However, at the same time, in regard to the relationship between people, for example, from Zimbabwe, in many cases, they're the same people. They speak the same languages. The Ndebele people are both in Zimbabwe as well as in South Africa. They're related to the Zulu population as well. Even the Mashona people exist both in Zimbabwe as well as in South Africa. The same is true with Malawi as well, formerly known as Nyasaland. So this requires a reexamination by the ruling party. It was positive today to see that people did go out in the streets in Durban to march against xenophobia, saying that these attacks have to stop, that we are all African people, we have to unite, and this is what is essential in order to move South Africa forward, in order to move Africa forward as a whole.
This past week saw a huge wave of workers' demonstrations sweep the United States, with workers demanding that the minimum wage be increased to $15 an hour. The Fight for 15 campaign swelled into what organizers said were the largest protests by low-wage workers in U.S. history. RT's Marina Portnaya was at one such protest here in New York, and she filed this report.
This movement began 2 years ago here in New York City when just 200 fast food workers walked off the job protesting low wages. Today, thousands of employees from retail, airport services, hospitality, home care industries, as well as unions have joined the fight for a $15 an hour wage. Now here in New York City, thousands have been flooding the streets, clogging intersections, even staging die-ins in front of fast food restaurants. Clearly this campaign has gained tremendous momentum. Now in New York, the minimum wage is $8.75 an hour, not nearly enough to keep up with the cost of living in New York City.
How is it surviving on minimum wage of $8.75?
Very difficult. Very difficult. Sometimes you end up having to get two jobs to be able to make ends meet.
Minimum wage just doesn't cut it. You won't. It's either rent or food, and that's wrong.
America's totally out of whack. We have a very small percentage of people making a phenomenal amount of money, and the rest can't even pay their rent. And it's worse than it's ever been, and we got to stand up. We have to ask for a bare minimum.
According to a study released by the Berkeley Center for Labor Research, state and federal governments spend more than $150 billion a year on anti-poverty programs used by working families. And where do you think that money is coming from? American taxpayers. So essentially, Americans are subsidizing these large multinational corporations that won't pay their workers a living wage. These people on the street here in New York and in 200 cities across the country are demanding $15 an hour. And by all appearances, it seems that this battle is far from over.
Friday marked the beginning of the first working conference of the Union of South American Nations, or UNASUR, at its brand new headquarters. The group is celebrating this Friday its 8th anniversary with the official opening of the South American Defense School, created to provide instruction on defense and security issues, both at the civil and military level, following the principles of original strategic vision. For more on that and other news from Latin America and the Caribbean, we now go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
The big event of the weekend, apart from all the fallout from the what many people regarded as a historic 7th Summit of the Americas that was held in Panama on, when was it, Friday and Saturday of the last week. And there was a lot of fallout from that, and there was kind of mixed opinion, but in general, a lot of people saw it as a summit of the Americas in which Latin America made it more explicit than it had ever done before, as a united group of countries. across the political spectrum, that they regard themselves as an autonomous, independent region, no longer looking to the United States for advice or models or influence about, you know, how they should manage policy across the whole range of issues that affect any country's national agenda. And I think that message was very much played down and kind of minimized and marginalized from what I could gather from coverage in the United States. Would you say that that's true?
For sure. For sure.
So yeah, and then there'll be a lot of fallout from that, especially the what people focused on most, obviously, was the opening up towards Cuba, and also to some extent the events in Venezuela, where, and very, very clearly at that summit, there was a completely united front against the United States. Very, very serious military action in Colombia, in which 10 or 12 Colombian soldiers and many more were killed and many more were wounded in an engagement with the FARC guerrilla in the Cauca department in the southwest of the country, which is very much a stronghold of the FARC. And that very, very much impacts on the peace talks in Havana, of course.
Yes.
And the immediate response, the gut response of the government of President Juan Manuel Santos was to renew bombing attacks, the bombing campaign that they'd suspended not long ago. In fact, the decision to suspend it was only taken a short while ago. And in some sense, one almost senses that there are factions inside the Colombian military that deliberately engaged in that attack against the FARC in what is their stronghold, one of their strongholds in Colombia, so as to provoke that reaction from the government and throw a spoke in the progress of the peace negotiations in Havana. But the nitty-gritty there is that while there may be a short-term fierce reaction from the Colombian government, in the medium and long term, they're not going to jeopardize those peace talks, because those peace talks are supported by the whole South American region, the whole Latin American region, the whole Caribbean region as well. Because one sometimes forgets that Colombia has a strong Caribbean presence as a result of its coastline. And that in terms of the internal politics of Colombia, more and more pressure is being brought to bear on Alvaro Uribe.
Right.
It's possible. And for example, another associate of his has just been sentenced by the Colombian justice system for corruption and involvement in paramilitary abuses.
Right.
So it's one way of reading this recent incident in Colombia, and I think it's an accurate way of reading it, is that in order to kind of attempt to lift some of the pressure on Alvaro Uribe and his circle, who are in sharp opposition to the peace talks in Havana. Alvaro Uribe's allies in the Colombian military staged this attack in Cauca.
Yeah, you know, because to me, when I first heard about the attack, it sounded to me very much like a John Bolton-style operation, that where they would provoke it and then point fingers and then break up the peace talks. And we know Uribe has been opposed to the peace talks, and he lost his party lost the election over the peace talks to the Dos Santos' faction. And the pressure, you know, in the court system has been on Uribe's people, and this seems just like tailor-made to try to back the pressure off of Uribe.
Yeah, and I share that interpretation. It's a very common interpretation among people from the center to the left of the political spectrum here in Latin America. And in relation to that, something that's quite interesting is that the other day, UNASUR, the Union of South American States, inaugurated the South America Defense School.
Right.
And that is linked into what we were talking about at the beginning of the program in terms of South America becoming more and more autonomous and emancipating itself from undue deference and undue influence vis-a-vis the United States. And that's very much, the inauguration of this South America Defense School is very much in tune with the vision of precursors of the current wave of South American and Latin American and Caribbean emancipation. People like Sandino, for example, envisaged that kind of Latin American school, whereby it would be the countries of South America, Central America, and the Caribbean that would decide what their criteria would be for setting up the school, and it would be for people from Latin America. Mm-hmm. Historically, as you know, and as the School of America's Watch, that organization that has been so courageously led for a long time by Roy Bourgeois,
that's right.
Father Bourgeois and his colleagues, and they have long been denouncing the fact that Latin American military are trained by the United States and then go back to engage in repression against their own people. So this South American Defense School is very, very clearly something that's set up in clear moral opposition and political opposition to the so-called School of the Americas. And in that context, another event that's coming up here in Central America, in the region, that may be of interest to people is the beatification of Archbishop Oscar Romero, who was murdered back in the early 1980s by U.S.-trained death squads while he was actually giving mass.
Right.
Which is, that was a huge taboo. When he was murdered, that was such a grotesque violation of all the most fundamental norms of any kind of civilized society.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that scenario was part of the heaviest propaganda, Cold War propaganda, used against China and against Russia. There was Cardinal Menzenti, there were fictional pieces that showed priests being dragged out from mass and executed by the communists all through the 50s. And they actually played that scenario out with U.S.-trained forces against Archbishop Romero.
And, of course, that shocking assassination of Oscar Romero by U.S.-trained death squads from the Salvadoran army occurred around the same time, or very shortly before, the murder of four North American
nuns.
Religious women.
Right, the Mary Knollers, yep.
Yeah.
I'm here in Austin, New York, which is where Mary Knoll is based. I'm very familiar with that case.
So that's, so the fact that his beatification is coming up on May the 23rd, I think is the date. And that's going to be, in many ways, it'll be a very healing event in El Salvador. And it puts him as an iconic is such an overused word, isn't it? But it just puts Oscar Romero far beyond criticism. It makes him a national figure, a national leader, the national leader that he's always been. But it'll kind of consecrate that in a way that it will be absolutely impossible for the right wing to sully or smear in the future.
All right, literally, he'll be a national saint.
Yeah.
Sanctioned by the Vatican.
Yeah, so that's a very big deal in a region that's still over 50% Roman Catholic.
That's right.
So then I'm back, staying in the region here. We've got another opinion poll from the very respected researchers, market researchers. They're an outfit called M&R. And this latest poll gives an approval rating for Daniel Ortega of around 75%. And remember, that's after getting on for 9 years of Sandinista government under Daniel Ortega.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.